Hey there, everybody. It's been a while. You're listening to Little Wars on the Right Wing Entertainment Squad's network. I'm one of your co-hosts, Mongoose Kikimura, and with me, as always, is my buddy, Jack Carinette. Yo, buddy, still alive?
I am still alive. Absolutely.
And the self-appointed premier of the Union of Collectivized Wignat Confederacies here is John. How you doing, John?
That's so many titles. I can only hope I live up to your expectations. Comrade Borther?
Comrade Borther, yeah. So, this has been a pretty good last couple of weeks for me. So, it's been a while since we've recorded anything. So, has anybody done anything interesting lately in the world of traditional games? Jack, how about you? You done anything interesting?
Over the last couple of weeks, I actually primed and painted the first three colors on my cool Stargate, and I also put together a few squads of Marines. I painted a few of them, not too many, and that's pretty much it. I haven't gotten a game together, though, which I wanted to do for a while now, but...
Wait a second. I know for a fact, because I just re-listened to it today, that you've used that Stargate in a game before.
Yes.
Are you saying that you had a boring gray Stargate on the field?
Yes.
Wait, Jack, are you serious?
I am.
I'm gonna have to drive out to where you live, and I'm gonna have to beat your ass.
This is a hard disavow.
Do you have any, like, first or second edition dreadnoughts that I can stuff in a sock to beat you with?
I do, actually.
Because I don't actually own any first or second edition metal dreadnoughts, so I might need to borrow one.
That's okay, you can
this
borrow
is,
one.
This
because
is,
you're
like,
my friend.
You know, the samurai have their seppuku, the Muslims and the Mohammedans have their honor killings, we wargamers have the you disrespected the hobby... Now I have to beat you up with a first edition dreadnought and a sock.
I think it's called Deep Strike to the Face.
Deep Strike to the Face. Yeah, that's about it.
I have dishonored my refuge. Bam!
Dishonored my chapter!
Wait, that actually begs a very important question. You know, GW is turning an eye towards racial diversity. When are we actually just going to get cool as fuck samurai marines?
Never. Never.
Would that be a chain katana?
Dude, a chain katana sounds awesome. Cast teleport, teleports behind you, unsheaths chain katana, revs up chain
deep,
katana. Nothing
deep
personnel.
Deep strikes behind you.
Demon prince. Oh, deep strikes behind you.
Deep strikes behind you.
Cast nice. Teleport, deep strikes behind you, unsheaths chain katana. Nothing personnel, demon prince. If only.
I mean, what's the logic there? Is that chain katana, like, have 1,000 RPMs?
Each individual chain in the chain katana is folded over a million times in the highest quality plasteel this side of Terra.
Oh, okay.
The East, the Galactic East, will show no mercy today.
So what would be the name of this chapter, then?
The Rising Suns, obviously.
Rising Suns. Naruto. You get the little
I
kind of
want origami. You know, can we put origami in there somewhere?
Papercraft and origami?
You know, I really want the chapter symbol to be the frickin' Naruto headband symbol. That would be lit.
I got
great.
It. We'll call it the paper dragons.
The paper dragons.
And they use the Naruto symbol.
This is great.
On their pauldrons.
This will never happen, though, because the Japanese are not sufficiently diverse enough.
Yeah, ooh. No. All the ethnic diversity is going to be of other kinds that aren't as cool and fun.
Wow, way to really crap on this paper dragon parade here.
We're basically going to get Wakanda, the Space Marine chapter.
John and I are probably going to save what we did this, some of what we did this in the past a little bit here for later. But I will say that as of late, I had a couple of very good Flames of War games with a good friend of the show, Clement. That was a lot of fun. One of them we learned that you can't play an evenly paced mission with between two infantry companies, and the other one we learned the valuable lesson of Americans in mid-war have 50 cals on literally every vehicle, which makes airstrikes against them kind of futile. But beyond that, not a whole lot was going on there, so that's that. I also, and this kind of gets into it, I did buy into a sort of quote-unquote new, I say quote-unquote because it's not necessarily a new game, it's more of an adaptation of the pre-existing Flames of War rule set for World War III, but I did buy into Team Yankee, and I did want to talk about that a little bit. So, Team Yankee is Zog-on-Zog combat. You get to choose your Zog or Iran. And the Zogs available to you are basically like America, England, France, West Germany, East Germany, Czechoslovakia, Poland. I think you have the Dutch, Canada, and the Australians in there too. And then on top of that, you have Syria, Iraq, Israel, and Iran. So I chose to play as the Soviets because I wanted to make, because the game takes place in 1985 and I wanted to make a Afghan war themed force, even though that's not really a thing that's represented in the game. I wanted to do it because I've never really done desert basing before and I figured it'd be fun.
You're going to make Mujahideen?
No, I'm playing as Soviets. I'm not playing as Mujahideen. I didn't choose that Zog.
He's LARPing as himself in the future.
Oh, okay.
Nazbol gang, rise up. The actual lore of Team Yankee is kind of funny. Instead of after what was his name, Brezhnev resigns and the two guys take over, like there was a two premiers that only served for like a couple of years, and then what's his name, Gorbachev takes over. Instead of Gorbachev taking over, the party selects this old crusty-ass dude from the Stalin times who isn't named. They just say old crusty-ass dude from the Stalin times, basically. So basically, it's just like Stalin 2.0, and they decide to invade everybody, which is pretty rad. It's basically just Command and Conquer Red Alert.
So are they pulling the whole, like, Maputin dictator bit?
It's not Maputin dictator. The bit is, we need a contrived premise to have America and Russia fight each other in 1985 for this war game. So this is the way we can make it work. Really?
I don't know. I really like the whole, like, Einstein goes back in time and destroys the timeline and forces this massive war.
That was Red Alert 3, wasn't it?
That was Red Alert 1.
Oh, that's right. Okay, yeah, no. I most recently played the Red Alert 3. I'd forgotten about that.
Yeah, the thing about that is they don't really ever actually see the people that make these games, Battlefront, they try to like maintain an air of this is historical in some sense, so they're not really going to do the entire time traveling bit. The closest they got was releasing models for experimental pieces of World War II equipment and
Tesla coils.
No. More like, this is a tank that never saw frontline service in any appreciable numbers, but you can field a couple in your force if you want. Pretty tame stuff, all things considered. So the game itself sticks to the 4th edition Flames of War formula. In fact, it came out prior to 4th edition Flames of War, so a lot of the rules were like the prototyping for it, so it has some weird idiosyncrasies that I really won't go into. Some minor details. The only real major one is that if your formation commander dies, the entire formation runs away, which is very different and changes the tempo of the game by quite a bit, especially considering how much more lethal, accurate, and long-range everything is in this game. The really big change between Team Yankee and any other game I've played is the way it handles helicopters, or the fact that it has helicopters. So a lot of games have flyers that come on and leave. I know Drop Zone Commander, which is probably the most heavily aircraft-focused game there is, uses a lot of aircraft that come in, do their job, and then leave. And Warhammer 40K has flyers that fly around. Team Yankee has a mix of the two. You have strike aircraft that come in and shoot and leave, and then helicopters will stay hovering as long as you want them to, and they can move anywhere on the board facing any direction, anywhere they want, any turn. And then they can fly off the board, and you can keep them there and then have them come back as long as you have them. And they can just sort of fly around and do their thing. But the way they balance this is by giving everything the ability to shoot at helicopters. Like, if something's a guided missile, it could shoot at a helicopter. About half the autocannons in the game are double as anti-helicopter weapons. Just about anything can shoot at a helicopter, really. So that poses a lot of risks, so you have to be clever. You can put them near terrain, but there's a lot of good interplay there that you just don't see with a lot of... The one thing I do like about this game is, despite a lot of parts of it that I think could use some work, especially the morale rules, the helicopters and the work they've done in their aircraft and their anti-aircraft systems with guided missiles and all that, I think that really stands out as kind of unique among a war game. And in fact, it does give you the option of fielding some halfway decent in terms of like monetary cost and gameplay air mobile forces that are mounted entirely in helicopters, and some forces that allow you to spam helicopters by quite a bit too.
See, I like that that version of how they treat aircraft. Honestly, it's got a lot of dynamism, and as you said, it's incredibly it's kind of risky too.
It is very good. The thing I really like about it, though, is that more so than any other system of air vehicular combat I've seen, other than maybe Drop Zone Commander, this one shows that somebody sat down and thought all this out. Like, there was some people that took a concerted effort and thought, at least even over the course of like maybe an hour or two, they kind of brainstormed and thought, how do we make helicopters work? How do we make aircraft work on a mass scale in a game that's going to have a lot of aircraft? And the game makes it work really well. Anti-aircraft is kind of balanced into your force. That's kind of a thing you need to take. There are different kinds of anti-aircraft units that do different things. The other thing that's worth noting in Team Yankee is things move incredibly quickly across the board, like ridiculously fast. Like, your baseline tanks are moving like 14 inches and then shooting and then like can move on top of that. And if they're like just moving across the board, they're moving like 28 inches generally without shooting. So you're looking at basically covering the entire width of a 4-foot board in two turns with change to maneuver around terrain. So you can get where you want to go incredibly quickly. On the contrary side, all the weapons in this game are really, really deadly. So the way it works is it's kind of like Flames of War, but with an even bigger escalation. Whereas with a normal game of Flames of War, you spend the first couple of turns kind of poking your opponent, moving around. You might kill a couple things. And then in the last several turns, everything dies very quickly because you're just sort of full-on engaging in a battle plan that you're kind of setting up for. I'd imagine that with Team Yankee, most games are going to follow that formula, but the killing starts sooner and it escalates a lot faster. So that's what that seems like. It's a pretty unique game, even with its like basically similar rule set to Flames of War. The force compositions and the units available do help it to really stand out, especially with the helicopters that sort of seem very different from anything I've seen in any other war game. Like, oddly enough, in this game, it is possible to force aircraft units to run away with morale checks. Fun fact.
What does that mean exactly? Run away with morale? Like cause a lot of morale checks?
Well, no. If you have a unit of aircraft, you can normally get them in like 2 to 4, or even 6 if you're playing Soviets aircraft. And if you shoot them down to their last aircraft, I believe you can force a unit last stand check where if they fail their morale check, the aircraft will run away.
Oh, interesting. Okay.
Yeah, that will force a unit last stand check. It's endemic to Flames. Everything in Flames can run away from morale, whether it's a tank unit, an armored transport unit, an infantry unit, an artillery unit, a man-packed gun unit, or an aircraft unit. there is a way to make it run away with morale. You don't have to shoot every single thing off the board, which is a big difference from other games that do aircraft, especially your 40K-like games where aircraft are kind of always on the field, kind of flying around doing weird stuff. Have they fixed that, by the way?
What do you mean exactly?
Did they, when they went from 7th to 8th edition, did they fix aircraft at all?
I think they fixed aircraft enough. I mean, so
Enough.
the well, yeah, right, exactly. So the thing about aircraft though is that they don't, like I guess there are different levels. Like there are units that have the keyword that have the fly keyword, and they have slightly different rules to them. So and many of the actual aircraft have like a supersonic ability where if you're shooting at it from the ground, you get a negative one to hit.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
What about do they still have to move every turn?
Some of them. That's also in the supersonic ability. So like if you have an aircraft that must move every turn, it'll actually say this. It'll actually say in the movement inches, it's like 21 to like 34. But like taking my Corvus Blackstar for instance, it can actually drop into hover mode or I don't know, jet mode, I guess. And it has different movement for that. And when it's in jet mode, I get a negative one to hit for things shooting at me. But when I drop into hover mode, nothing, everything can hit me.
Better question, do they still have the like weird turning angles?
No.
So all aircraft can just maneuver around like 180 degrees on the spot?
Actually, that's not true. There are a few pretty much for most aircraft that operate like helicopters, but there are a few jet aircraft like Eldar jet fighters that actually do have a like a you must turn 90 degrees or whatever if you do turn or whatever, and they can go off the board and come back on.
Oh no. It's always been this way.
Yeah, but
They're never
most,
going to fix this.
well, yeah, but then again, like most aircraft, I feel like most aircraft now have a hover mode where you don't have to go off the board if you don't
Yeah,
want to.
yeah. It just doesn't help that they've designed themselves into a corner with a lot of that stuff.
Yeah.
So, speaking of other games that are slowly getting ruined and will never be fixed.
Oh, yes. I know where you're going with this too.
Yep.
Is this the part where I unmute
Yeah,
myself?
this is the part where you unmute yourself. This is the part where we return to the old whipping boy, the old whipping boy, the old. Probably edit that out in post. This is the part where we old.
Was terrible,
I know
yeah.
it
I don't
was.
know what was going on there.
I'm not editing any of that out. That's staying. You
Okay.
deserve all of
Yeah, yep, you're
that.
probably right. But my cringy bullshit aside, we are going back to everybody's favorite whipping post, dead horse that we've beaten to death, then we promptly beat it into a paste. Now we're beating that paste into a slurry. And then at some point, we'll probably just beat that slurry into a regular liquid. We're looking at Wizards of the Coast and everyone's favorite Wizards of the Coast game. And by favorite, I mean the only one of their games that's probably ever worth playing for any amount of time or was worth playing at some point.
And profitable for them.
And profitable too. Magic the Gathering, which, unlike D&D, there is a reason that at some point in time you probably did play this game and you probably actually had fun and it probably was actually a good game when you played it.
No.
Unlike many of their other products.
John just doesn't like anything, do you?
I do like things, just not these things. I don't get the collectible card thing. It's like, hey, do you want to just burn your money? I've got paper and I'll trade it for your money. And it's like, That's such a, it's like very blatant with the whole Skinner box thing of like, we're gonna constantly be pumping out new cards and they're slightly better than the old ones to make the old ones out of season, which is.
I will say this, that Magic the Gathering is better than Funko Pops in terms of Soy Boy collectibles, because at least you can do things with it.
No, I disagree because Funko Pops are always the same as when you bought them. They stay the same thing. However, the context of a Magic the Gathering card changes based on the new cards they pump out. It is literally inflation.
That the same thing actually happens with Funko Pops because they have a secondary market and they produce artificial scarcity with them. Like, people will resell the Funko Pops for an inordinate amount of
That.
money.
Okay, so what you're saying is that a Funko Pop is a better investment than Magic the Gathering.
No,
The value
actually,
goes
it
up over
depends. No,
time.
it depends on the Funko Pop you buy.
Okay, but it still, over time, becomes more rare and more, thus the price would go up. Whereas Magic the Gathering cards that are like, don't have any value to them after amount of time because they've inflated the power level of everything else around them.
Dude, 10 years ago, I knew a guy. He lived out of his car, but I knew a guy and out of his store who had a corner store right next to a comic book shop, and all he did was buy, sell, and trade Magic cards. That's all
Yeah,
he did.
short term though. Short term though.
True. I mean, he
I'd say
operated
about
on a
10 years
short
later,
term.
are any of those cards that he was selling or buying 10 years ago still hot items today?
There are
Well,
quite a few, actually.
yeah, and you actually it's a little bit like the stock market, kinda sorta, because you
So
have to
fake and
be,
gay.
yes, and
And
probably
Jewish.
Jewish.
It is a Jewish for a fact.
Yeah, not probably.
But yeah, like he would specifically he would specifically buy or trade certain cards at a loss because he knew down the line that those cards would return in a block and they would be incredibly powerful and thus incredibly expensive. He didn't know exactly how expensive, but he was kind of betting on that, right?
It's like card speculating.
It's literally card speculating. Yes. It was really, really weird. He was a pretty cool guy though, and he owned the entire store, so we could just go there and pick up a game. It was really easy to pick up a game, but yeah. So.
Now, I will say the reason I say Magic the Gathering had value as a game is not because of the actual competitive scene that requires you to buy and sell cards, but because on its face, like just playing kitchen table Magic the Gathering where you have anything goes with you and your buddy and you just kind of have some cards you play with, I think that that is a very fun game and it can be a fun experience for a little bit and for a while, and I have fond memories of it. So, I mean, that's fine. It's just like with a lot of things, you get people that take it to this weird extreme where it does become this bizarre Skinner box stock market, unless like you and your buddy playing trading cards when you're kids. And that's the issue I think that most people would have with it personally.
Yeah, I also think that it had something that was very similar to other kinds of games like it, in that it had a relatively high, I mean like you had to pay for the cards. So it wasn't like it wasn't like a lot of these other Bugman bullshit where you could like pay for a Funko Pop figurine, right? Like you had to get the cards and then you actually had to use them in a skillful way. And that kind of I guess you could say, at least back in the times in which I played it, it kind of filtered out all those people that, were not I don't know, I guess would have taken the game in a very Bugmanish way and just kind of left the
Okay, but how does this somehow better than the loot box nonsense from video games, where you buy the little pack in the flashy colors and you have a chance of getting a slightly, rare or a better item or whatever that can improve your quality in your game? Like, everybody complains about it when EA shoves that nonsense into video games. Why is it somehow better when it's like you have a little paper card that's overpriced?
My contention isn't that, well, see, my contention is that it's fun if you just buy a certain amount and then you just play with those with your buddies ad infinitum. If you get stuck in the Skinner box, it's problematic. Yeah. No, I'm not. Yes. I'm not contending with you on that level.
Okay. All right. Fair enough.
This also reminds me. Shout out to Josh Hawley, who is the official senator of Little Wars.
Wait, what? What did he do?
He's the senator that's introducing legislation to either tone down or remove loot boxes from video games because.
Oh yeah, that guy. Okay.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, next he needs to get on to Magic the Gathering.
Yeah, right? Yeah. I'm gonna. You know what? You know what? Send me his details after the show. We'll write him a letter.
Oh, that's that sounds an amazing idea.
Yeah. While you're at it, we have some additional ideas. We like where your head's at, but we think you could be a bit more ambitious.
Let me point out
here's a grand list of soy boy gambling activities we would like you to count crack down on. Also, by the way, here's a book and some pages out of it. If you could have the NSF fund making these waifus real, that would be appreciated
okay.
as well.
All right, now you're asking too much. Dial it back.
Okay. Is writing letters to senators asking for a monster girl wife a form of soy boy gambling, or is it just like a form of another form of gambling?
It's not gambling, it's just begging.
Yeah, I suppose.
Ma'am, please.
Yeah, that's what I was thinking of. Please, sir, may I have some monster girl?
Please, sir, can I have a nugget of Kikimora, please?
I've been a good boy, please, Senator.
I paid my taxes. I obeyed all the laws. I have never gotten a traffic ticket in my entire life. All these things are
true. If anyone deserves a monster girl, it's me, sir.
Oh, jeez. Oh, wow. So other unwholesome activities, we have some nice, fun bits from the creative development team at Wizards of the Coast on their FAQ Anon Ask blog that they host on Tumblr, which you can always kind of tell that something's going to shit if it has an Anon Ask blog on Tumblr. A lot of the Black Library authors for 40K have them now, for example. But
wait, what?
Yeah, there's a couple Black Library authors who do.
Oh, Black Library. I thought. Okay, never mind.
Cool. No, not the rules authors for 40K. That's coming later.
Yeah.
No. The librarians who are African American.
Yeah, that's what
yes.
Anyway, go on.
So we've got some excerpts that Jack has found and provided for us. And Jack, would you mind talking about these couple of asks that they have, and then we can go over some of this card art that they're talking about?
Oh yeah. Okay. So, so this is from.
We'll go over the card art last because our viewers can't see it, but we can describe it in such vivid detail that they'll know exactly what we're talking about.
Okay. Absolutely. We can't get that explicit on the show.
Ooh. Okay, so
you know it's bad when the Wignat says it's bad.
Yeah, right. You know it's bad when the Wignat is like, guys, let's tone it down a little bit.
Well, it's because you know what word I'm gonna have to use to describe this properly. You know the gamer word here.
I'm gonna say.
Yeah, I'm gonna describe the magic art.
I'm gonna describe.
No, no, like, Mrs. Obama, get down.
I tap two black mana.
Thank you. I have no idea about anything about magic, so I had no idea like what to say for a joke, but your service is appreciated.
Mrs. Obama, ready your counterspell.
Implying she plays blue. Come on, she's not intelligent.
It's blue,
anyway.
It's blue black.
Oh, there you go. Yeah.
Bluish, you know? I mean, blue is the color of metamorphosis. That's kind of like the color of being trans.
Right, and I was going to say, oh, Mrs. Obama is actually the second Mr. Obama, so that's pretty appropriate.
Right.
Michael Obama probably plays as the metamorphosis color.
Blue, black, and green. There you go. Because blue-green
There's something green there, that's for sure.
Ooh, ooh, gangrene. Ooh.
Okay.
Yeet. Oh,
okay.
What?
That's the color of... All right, anyway, go ahead.
I need to level up my racism, apparently. So the first image.
This is no. Hold on. This is transphobia.
Oh, sorry.
No, this is actually intersectionalism. We're being like racist and transphobic. Yeah.
That's a good point. Yeah, and sexist a little bit,
and
too.
A little bit anti-Semitic with like the bluish question, bluish.
And homophobic.
Oh,
homophobic.
Yeah, yeah.
So who's the Eric Stryker that does intersectionality?
That's Mongoose. That's Mongoose, obviously. Come on. He wants to live in Afghanistan as a communist.
That's true.
Obviously Mongoose.
He is fielding Soviets. That's great.
In Afghanistan, because I want to live in a bombed out BMP with my Lamia waifu next to a tribe of Pashtuns and trade AK-47 bullets for goat meat.
He's like Stryker once he ascends to the Monster Girl pill.
Inshallah, brothers.
Inshallah, brothers.
Inshallah.
Yeah.
Oh, Inshallah.
Okay, so we've been like punning for like.
Oh yeah. Okay. All right. Sorry.
So this first anonymous. Well, it's not actually anonymous. It's just an ask from Tumblr, from markrosewater.tumblr.com. By the way.
Mark Rosewater.
Rosewater.
Yeah.
Stop saying it. I'm gonna have to echo every time you say it.
So his blog is called Blogatog, which is a
pun off of a old magic card called Atog or Atog or something like that.
Yeah.
Or Togatog.
I fucking hate this shit.
It's also probably something in the Kabbalah, though, let's be honest.
Yeah. just like the live long and prosper sign.
It's it's Lilith's second son, Atog Blogatog.
The
demon of pestilence, you know, he pukes, he goes Blogatog. Okay, that wasn't so good.
That was like a Pokemon joke. That was awful. Like the demons in Kabbalah can only say their names.
I was trying to like make a riff of like Blogatog sounds a little bit like somebody puking, but that kind of works.
No, I got it, but yeah, I get it. Can you tell that I don't want to talk about this? This is so cringe.
Yeah, it is. So the guy Apoc the Combo Mancer. Oh man. Asked, with all this talk of women/POC versus non-human planeswalkers, why not drop male human planeswalkers for a while to give more women/POC and non-human? We obviously have plenty of male human planeswalker.
And now people, that's POC is people of crime?
People of crime, that is correct.
Okay.
Or a color. I think it's actually people of color.
Well, if you're talking about magic, aren't you
going
to be more specific about the color?
In this context, wouldn't it be... Oh.
No, because that's K, yeah. Yeah. Anyway, he responds, the last time we made a planeswalker card of new human male character was Dak Faden in Original Conspiracy 2014, which, by the way, I haven't played in so long that I don't recognize this guy.
I know Dak who Faden. He is. He was a red-blue planeswalker introduced in the Original Conspiracy set. Nothing else you need to know. Moving on.
Which is he? But was he black, though?
No, he's a white male.
Oh, okay.
Dak Faden was actually the last white male planeswalker they've created. The rest of the white male planeswalker cards that have been new have been reprints or redos of old characters. Because a lot of planeswalkers will be like, this planeswalker, but with slightly different powers, but it's the same dude. So, like, you know.
Right, and he goes into that. And a non-supplemental set was Ral Zarak in Dragon's Mark? Dragon's Maze. Both, by the way, were pre-existing characters already in the lore. So he's actually... this is really funny. Mark Rosewater is actually saying, well, here are two characters that we made into Planeswalkers, but these are actually characters that already existed. So he's not actually saying... when the last white male
those were the last new white males and they already existed in the lore, so what he's saying here is, because then he goes on to say and read that
we are using our new character slots to expand our planeswalker roster diversity.
So basically what he's saying is that when you have new magic characters, they're all going to be Jewish, queer, and transsexual, and those things are going to be related.
And a woman.
They're going to be Antifa.
I just want to step in here and say real quick, guys, you do not want rooster diversity, because different types of roosters actually will fight each other. They will have crowing wars. They will wake you up at ungodly hour Oh, sorry. Roster diversity. Roster. Yeah, okay.
Because I can't remember the last time we made a rooster planeswalker. I feel very discriminated against.
Are you saying that they're discriminating against gays because there's not enough cock?
Oh, sorry.
I don't know, Mongoose, what do you want from me? This is so dumb. I don't know what to say about this.
This is a
Jew. He's a Jew. He hates white people and men. Stop the presses.
But,
ring the bells.
But you see, the thing about this is, though, is that he is essentially, but he does something that not everyone does, though. He is actually giving you, like, he is actually telling you, we are not making another white male for this.
Yeah,
for
they never
slots.
They never say that explicitly. Yeah. Like, this is like the only time it's ever been said explicitly, which is interesting.
J.J. Abrams can say how he walks into a room and it's overbearingly white, and I want my entire cast to only be Asians. It's just like, I don't know. I guess this is rare in this hobby, I guess.
Yeah, but, it is.
Well, no, because even Roll20 just recently did that whole thing where, like, some guys tried to do an official Roll20-sponsored game, and they looked at him and said, no, we don't want any more white men. So it's like, ugh. This is just the whole...
Well, here's the other thing. You want me to go into like the Mongoose post on this, the Mongoose take?
Sure.
Please
okay,
do.
So you notice the last time they introduced new white male characters into the lore was some odd like 2012-ish, I think, would be when these guys were introduced into the lore as pre-existing characters. So we're talking 7 years ago, right? Warhammer 40K, fun fact, has a tendency to reuse characters as well. So what do you think's going to happen when they start deciding to introduce new characters? Mm-hmm. We haven't introduced a single white character since the reprint of Girly Man.
Mm. Well, you love tokenism anyway, so what is...
Well,
you know,
tokenism's...
You'd just probably be
tokenism,
happy.
This is different than tokenism.
Tokenism is fine as long as they're white.
No, tokenism.
No,
is
Mongoose
like the...
likes the one funny black guy in the squad.
You know,
tokenism.
That's
true. Tokenism is like okay, and when it's like, if you're riffing on 80s action movies, which parts of 40K are, right? Like that's an obvious like okay, this is a trope in the genre, so like we're gonna like do the bit. But this is Magic: The Gathering is not an 80s action movie. The Magic: The Gathering plot is actually worse than like an 80s action movie plot, which is saying something.
Yeah. Wow. All right.
Nobody plays Magic: The Gathering for the plot.
I believe that actually. Yeah.
Yeah, nobody does. And the people that play it, like, care about the plot are always like the weirdest, most spurgiest people you'll ever meet. Like,
well, you know what they probably play it for is the fantastic artwork.
Oh yeah,
that,
yeah.
That was actually true back years and years ago.
Yeah, that was true at some point.
Oh.
Yeah.
Oh, I didn't know that. Okay.
Yeah, right, yeah, cool. like you get
they actually
sucked
had legitimately
in by these...
good art.
There's a lot of Magic: The Gathering card art that is actually legitimately just incredible to look at. And now we have sassyblackwoman.gif.
Oh yeah. Yeah.
So we have here for the spell quench, it's got a eyebrow shift and slight upturn in her smile, and quench is more than just another counter. It's a big mood, and a white guy couldn't add that layer of depth as easily. That is to say that you need a black woman to do the uppity negress bit, which is true. White people do not do that uppity, like, semi-smug, but also, like, uppity bit that, like, the sassy black lady Beyonce.gif, like, white thought thing.
Okay. You're right. I'm a little disappointed because you're not doing your like quenchiest bit, and your perverse whatever thing will never be quenched.
Yes. Well, you've got to edit that in post because that's like an actual drop from Sammy Classic Sonic fan. I mean,
the second thing is I want to get into an esoteric analysis of this art.
Okay.
And the meaning behind it, right? Because here is this sassy black woman, right?
Yes.
And this spell is quench, and if you look at the art, she is siphoning away this light.
It's a fireball
that
or
looks
something,
to be.
Yeah.
Let me spin my narrative here. I'm trying to spin a narrative. Okay, he is. So she.
What's that on your computer? What's that on your computer?
Oh no, that's my bit. I'm doing the mic. Damn it! You're supposed to be doing the funny songs.
Do you have your picnic?
I got a lot of ranch. All right. Okay. Good. So I'm gonna cut all this out because this is dumb. Okay. Starting over. Okay. All right. So I want to do a little bit of an esoteric analysis of the art here, because this sassy black woman is holding her hand out, and she's got this like water orb that's floating above her hand.
Yes.
And there is this beam, or like this little rivulet of light that is flowing off screen into the center of this water, and it is coalescing.
It's like being sucked in.
Yeah, it's being sucked in, coalescing in the middle, and it's clearly this fire, this light that's being pulled into there is being put out by the water. You can see the steam coming out of the top of this orb of water.
Oh yeah, I didn't notice that.
What they're saying is that when you put sassy black women in charge, they will suck in the light and the fire of your civilization and quench it under their drowning waters.
So what, of never drowning sassiness?
So what you're saying, John, is that their sick fantasies can never be quenched.
Thank you.
That's your cue to edit that in post.
Because you freaking fricks just can't ever be quenched. Your fantasies can't ever be quenched, can they?
Everybody laugh. Damn it. That's terrible.
Yeah,
okay, stop laughing.
Yeah, so I actually have a different esoteric take on this, honestly.
Okay. Go ahead.
And my esoteric take on this is, so like, you know how when anybody posts like something, like the Yas Queen Slay crowd on Twitter, like these like obnoxious white thoughts will post these gifs of like Beyonce and like these sassy black women and shit, right?
I'm not on Twitter.
Well, yeah, well, that's a thing that happens. There you go.
Oh, okay.
And it's just obnoxious and disgusting, and is one of the most disgusting things that 21st century neoliberal capitalist America has ever produced. And this is like that in Magic the Gathering card form. It's a counterspell, which what it does is you play a counterspell to prevent your opponent from casting a spell. So it fulfills in the game the same role as that like disgusting like Beyonce gif where she's like wagging her finger or whatever, or like she's like doing like the sassy bit. Like, it's literally just,
or like sipping a teacup,
yeah, that kind of stuff. It's like that smug like big mood, like, oh, I'm countering you, like you've been canceled. Like, actually, cancel is literally
a
counter spell.
Didn't.
Yeah, it's literally that, and it's literally that in both art rules, and it's this card makes me ill to look at. I'm gonna be honest, I don't like the way it looks. It looks disgusting. It's an inaccurate portrayal of the black woman, because her weight is probably coming from the metal armor she's wearing and not like just flabs of cellulose, and she doesn't look like a magical DMV official. So I'm gonna have to say I'm gonna press X to doubt on this one.
Yeah. No, I mean, it's just black people quench the light of civilization.
That's a high level take, and you got my low level take. You can pick between the two.
Okay.
Yeah, but either way, it's just it's blatantly like just nasty card art that's like supposed to like, it almost like is mocking the viewer. I do
agree though that a white guy couldn't add that layer of depth as easily, because this is a layer of depth to which we dare not dive.
Oh yeah, he's not wrong. He's not wrong.
Right. This is a level of depravity that white guys just don't want to delve into.
Well, I mean, a white guy, white dudes just don't do that entire, like, passive-aggressive bit. Like, if you push a white guy enough, he'll just punch you, right?
Oh, soy boys do.
Well, soy boys do, but that's because soy boys are, like...
women.
I wouldn't say, like, women. There's, like, this type of person that city, like, neoliberal corporate capitalism has created where they're all the same. And they all do this, like, passive-aggressive bit. But, like, you notice, like, very traditional women don't do this entire thing either. Like, it's... I think it's, like, an entirely separate form of, like... It's a bug person, right? And
yeah,
it takes,
it's
like,
almost like they've adopted a foreign culture and behavioral patterns.
Yeah, well, they've taken, like, the worst aspects of, like awful African-American behavior, awful, like, cuck-tier, like, sort of wimpy white people behavior, and they've sort of combined it all, and by your powers combined, I am Captain Awful. It's just awful.
And not just regular African American behavior either, like that bougie African American.
Oh yeah, no, it's not like the funny ones that yell about like Jordans and like go like yeet and yell at each other and like yell about like basketball and stuff. Like these are the ones that are like really like the frizzy haired mulatto. We're not talking about like the guy who's like yelling about like yeeting on a vine. It's just awful.
Yeah, it's just so very, you know, I mean okay, so if you look at the rest of the picture, she's wearing armor and you know, she's it goes into that category of females, you know, doing things that I don't know. They would have no business doing, even if they could quench a spell, you know.
I don't know about that. It's magic. Like you don't have to have like equal pay to pull off magic.
Yeah, I guess so.
I'm okay with a woman doing it. I'm less okay with the black, because it's like she's not doing voodoo. She's not doing like, you know, African shamanism or animalistic.
Fun fact, they did have a voodoo theme set in Magic the Gathering, and it was all about like Africans in Africa.
See, I'm okay with that.
Yeah.
There were like elephants and like tribal wizards and stuff, and it was actually pretty all right. Admittedly, it didn't sell well, but.
Well, yeah, who wants to play that?
Mirage, I think, right? That was Mirage.
Mirage was the. Arabian Nights. Yeah, it was Mirage. Arabian Nights was the like stereotypical Middle Eastern one, which was pretty great.
But like, this is. They're doing like elemental magic and whatnot, so it's like it just doesn't fit. It doesn't fit the aesthetic. She's wearing like some weird looking, almost like pseudo Greek or Roman armor or something. It's like, when have you ever had that in history? What is this? What's going on?
Yeah, it looks like it's made by like with like bronze or something, and it's layered, you know, with layers of armor. So this thing probably weighs a good 120 pounds.
I think that the best take on this is that the entire point of what you're looking at is to offend your aesthetic sensibilities, and that's it.
Yes, I absolutely.
Mission accomplished.
Agree.
This is a great card.
Yeah,
man.
That's the point.
Well, it's supposed to be. It's supposed to, you know, like when blue plays a counterspell, it's supposed to like piss you off.
Yeah, that's the other thing. Is like this is like the highest level, like. This is like a psychological attack on the sort of unawoken player base of Magic the Gathering that is predominantly white, that they won't understand why this melt spell card art makes them so mad, but it does, you know?
As Nick Mason says, all Aryan people should be angry. That was my Nick Mason quote of the episode.
You could have picked a better one, honestly.
sorry guys, my passions are just quenched right now.
Get it.
Well, I know what you're passionate about. You're passionate about role-playing games, right?
Is he?
I don't like your tone of voice, but yes.
Oh, you don't like my tone of voice? What do you think I'm going to talk about Tuna here? No, we're talking about the sessions we're playing.
Oh, okay.
Dude, I'm doing a bit here. So yeah, no, while the spell quench does break your immersion on several levels and make you angry, we want to talk about how to inspire other sorts of emotions when you play role-playing games, right? Because emotions are very important for storytelling, and they're very important to sort of build immersion. And we have some thoughts, or rather, John had some thoughts he wanted to share and want to talk about it with Jack. I don't really have many thoughts, because most of my thoughts come from John's thoughts on this. So, John, you just want to take this away?
Yeah, so I was thinking about it a bit because I have been running my campaign, and I think I did a pretty good job of inspiring some quite a bit of tension and some tense emotions there in my players. And then I was playing in your game, and I had some thoughts that I relayed to you that I think would make for an interesting segment on how to narratively set the scene and inspire the right sorts of emotions in your players based on your narration and this descriptive language you use and the specific words. And more so than that, even what I said to you was how you choose to focus your narration, because role-playing games, you know, they're very verbal acts, they're very verbal bits of art, and it can be likened to a movie or a novel in a certain way, in that only what is seen by the camera lens or written down in the words, or in this case spoken out loud by the game master, only that is what exists in terms of the world. So you can spend your time talking about whatever you want to, and the question is, do you just go over as many details as possible, or do you choose to linger and zoom in and emphasize certain things to try and inspire specific reactions in your players? And I don't mean actions, like you don't say there's a single door in this room and they're going to be like, well, I opened the door. I mean, like, do you choose to focus on very specific, ways that the NPCs are acting or moving, things like lighting, temperature, or just even like emotional descriptions, not by telling your players your characters are scared right now, but describing the trees and that they're, as they're walking through the woods, almost seeming to bow inward and press in on them from the sides, and the feeling that if they were to wander even just an inch left or right, their sleeves would be torn by thorns of these branches reaching out towards them. You're not telling them, hey, you're scared. But the way that you're describing the scene is very much creating the sense of claustrophobia and pressing danger that either the players can choose to latch onto, or they can, you know, they can ignore it. But if they're trying to be in character and roleplay well, then they'll kind of take that as a cue and they'll be able to build their character's emotions and moods based on that. It'll give them something to go off of. And I find that that can be a great way to help them get into character.
So I actually had a question in my mind when you were starting that whole spiel. You were juxtaposing two separate things, where you were saying that, you know, do you give your players as many small details as possible, however insignificant they are, or what was the second point?
Do you choose to, the first point was, do you describe things based on details of what they can see?
Mm.
So you walk up to an NPC and he's standing and leaning back against a wall. He's wearing a black shirt with a red vest on over the top and this type of hat. His face looks like this and looks like this. His eyes glance up as he's, or do you describe it more in terms that are like emotionally evocative? Like, you know, you step up to this guy leaning up against a building and he has an air about him as if he might dart off at any second. His eyes have a shiftiness that only narrows when he begins to realize that he has to deal with you. And you don't specifically mention, like, his clothes or, you know, the specifics of his posture. You give your player something to latch onto in terms of just evoking the emotions of the scene and let them fill in the details on their own. I'm saying, like, which one do you guys think is better?
I don't think that either one is particular. Okay, this is where I'm gonna do like the you can say like, oh, you're cucking out, but this is where I'm gonna say you need to understand, and I think I'm trying to build this understanding myself, but you need to have an understanding of when to use either. If you're like me, you probably have a very well thought out, sort of very deep, in-depth, interlinked, sort of webbed together setting where everything just sort of feeds into everything else kind of semi-organically. So if you describe a jacket as being a sort of, he's wearing a jacket in a brushstroke camouflage pattern, if a player had, let's say, explored the lore a little bit, they know, okay, this faction uses this, which means that he either bought surplus from them, he was with them, or someone from there gave it to him, right? And you can add little details like that. And so if you have a lot of little details in your setting that are worth exploring and can sort of reward players for diligence and sort of immersion, and that only helps to sort of strengthen that sort of idea that the setting itself is sort of interconnected and builds immersion. in combat, and I'm not the best at this, I will say it, I'm not very bad at describing combat sequences. You really want to spare a lot of details and focus on these emotions and things, especially because when you're looking at combat, what people remember from combat and firefights and stuff, if you ever read memoirs or things mm-hmm. people say about them, you'll very quickly sort of learn to realize that most people don't remember actually a whole lot they do remember specific details, but you'll always note that they're very odd, mostly having to do with color, smell, and sound.
That's actually a very great point.
And when you're doing this, you can kind of describe them as sort of sharp and intense, and you can kind of build emotion with emotionally charged descriptive words when you're doing combat and things. And you can sort of omit every single detail that you might want to include, but include the ones that you think would stay with them, like maybe the scent of blood, the sound of guns firing, the smell of sulfur, things of that nature, you know.
Mm-hmm. What I will say is that I think it's usually good to take two separate paths on this. What I usually like to do is during the high like mechanical parts of the game where people are rolling dice and in combat, I'll usually describe what happens just like that, like in a very emotional, evocative way. But if they're just standing around like a pub or a bar or something, you know, I like to give them way more details because they're just standing there like analyzing the scene, you know. So,
well, my stance on that would be that you, even in something like a pub scene, you can still decide what is the sort of emotion that you're looking to inspire in the players when they're in that pub. Is it one of like welcoming and you want them to stay a while? You know, then you could just go on about like the pleasant, you know, music filling your ears and setting your heart at ease, the comfort of the stools after the, you know, how long you've been on your feet walking around town. Mm-hmm. You can go on about that sort of thing without going into like, there are 17 bar stools and each of them has four legs except for two, which have three, and they look like they've been replaced from a different set.
At a certain point, going into like specific numbers of bar stools and things, I think is kind of
it's hyperbole.
Yeah, it is hyperbole.
And I think it should scale based on how perceptive you think the character is. Even so, going so far as to secretly giving the character with a higher perception, whatever stat that may be, like, you know, secret details about the room that not everyone can see.
That is an interesting thought.
That is a really good idea. I hadn't thought of that, but I like
it. I never directly thought of that to
like highlight things that you want them to notice by like pretending as if only one person is noticing it, and then it's like everyone's like, "Oh, wait, so that was harder to notice? Maybe we should all like kind of lean in and figure that out."
Yeah.
I like that.
Yeah. Yeah, and it kind of reflects real life a little bit, where, you know, I'm not the most perceptive person in the world. So when somebody points something out to me, I tend to like lean in and like, you know, look at it a little bit harder. So
right. I do think that this kind of sort of builds off of one's own personal experiences. For me, I have had I have a very strong sense of smell and hearing, and I have color blindness, so I'm very sensitive to sort of how things sound, how they smell, and what colors they are in a lot of ways. And those things kind of tend to stick out to me, I think, more strongly than the average person. I'm going to go out on a limb there and say that's probably the case. And I think that's sort of when I first heard someone say, like, I like to always describe how things smell, that stuck with me is that's probably the best idea I've ever heard, because I was thinking like, yeah, smells do leave a really big impact on me. I'm always thinking about the way things smell. I'll notice bad smells before most people. And I'm thinking to myself, that's a good descriptor, right? And that's one of the things I think John can attest to this. I usually try to always sort of remind everybody what something smells like, or at least give somebody a sort of reference point, because I do think that is important. It sort of does build this base level of immersion with the setting. And you never think about it until it's pointed out to you, but very often you'll go through entire campaigns where the game master never tells you, apart from like maybe extreme circumstances, was like rotting corpses or something like that, what your character's smelling. And it's very weird when you think about it, because you never thought of it before, but once it's sort of like brought to your attention, it does sort of stick out to you, or at least it stuck out to me.
Well, Mongoose, let me blow your mind right now.
Yeah.
And say that even when you're describing smells, there's still that dichotomy of descriptive versus evocative. Because you can say he smells, or this scene smells of pine trees. Or you could say this scene smells of winter and holidays and memories of home. And you could both of those could be describing the same thing. But they inspire in the person two different, you know, very different understandings. One is very clinical and true and accurate and scientific, and the other is more memory and emotional based.
That is true. One of the things I like to do is I like to give people a little bit of room, especially when I'm describing landscapes, I like to give people a little bit of room to sort of evoke emotions in their mind. So I'll even say, this smells like, and I'll try to relate it to a real life example with smells. And then that will, I hope, and in theory, evoke right. the emotions someone would feel while going on a hike or something like that, rather than sort of directly doing it myself. And that's...
Well, Mongoose, this seems to be defying Mongoose's first law.
Yeah, but that's...
Always treat your players as retards.
Yes, and one of the things you know is that retards are highly predictable and that they always can be fooled with psychological tricks. And smell sticks.
Well, that's what I'm saying. That's what I'm saying. The psychological trick is explaining the emotion the smell is supposed to evoke in the first place.
Well, I don't think you need to do that with smell, considering how strongly it correlates with memory. Like you remember smells more strongly than anything else.
Okay, but if I was to say to you, you walk through the marketplace and you can smell myrrh and nutmeg. Is that better or like more evocative than if I had said
what I'm describing is when I say like use a realistic or real life example, I would describe it as Christmas smell, right? But if I'm describing a forest, I might even say this smells like if I know my party is around around the Blue Ridge Mountains or have been there, I'd say like this smells like, you know, this smells kind of like a deciduous forest after a rainy day. And everybody kind of knows what that smells like, but each person's going to have their own sort of unique experiences attached to that. And they'll kind of get it, you know?
Yeah, I guess. I don't know. I see what you're saying, but I still think that there is value in at least... And again, it's all contextual because it depends on what you're trying to do in a scene. And that's why I suggested to you when you're, you know, planning things ahead of time or even on the fly, try to think of what emotion is this scene supposed to inspire and then kind of warp or bend your descriptions towards that goal of crafting that.
Well, and I think it also kind of depends on what you want to do with the scene as well. You know, like if you're all meeting at a bar, like is there a shadowy figure in the bar? Maybe things smell a lot less like Christmas, you know, or, you know, maybe.
Yeah, I agree. That's what I mean by think about what emotion this scene is supposed to inspire. Is it supposed to be that shifty sort of, you know, feeling in them? Okay, well, you know, there's an odd scent in the air, one you can't quite place. Each moment that you breathe in, you think it's something new, something pleasant. No, something off. No, something enjoyable and sweet. No, something sour. Like, you know, you could use that even to inspire the sense of, like, unease or restlessness.
I like this. This is good. This is something more DMs should do. I see so many DMs not providing adequate context for things, because you can describe how a scene looks as many times as you want, but, you know, you're very rarely given this kind of context that can pretty much only be given in like a book, you know what I mean?
I will say that I like John's theory, but I think I would personally prefer, and I do personally prefer, the use of simile rather than emotionally charged language, wherein you describe the color of something by giving it a comparison to something else that's already emotionally charged. like an example of this would be describing something the color of red as the color of like freshly bled blood. That gives you a little bit of emotional context while also giving you a red color.
Yeah. Well, I agree. That's one of the tools that should be in a toolbox of evocative descriptions.
Yes. And if you're listening to this and you take one thing away from this conversation, don't forget to describe how things smell.
Like that's, I feel like we focused on that a bit too much.
I feel like
all five of your senses.
That's true. Yes.
Yeah, I mean, sounds is a big one as well. And that was something that struck me on your last session, Mongoose, is that you described, when Render came into the prison, you hear yelling, you hear some more yelling. No, stop that and start yelling into your microphone. I want to actually hear high volume voices speaking at me. That sells it so much more than like, you hear yelling and there's more yelling.
I feel uncomfortable yelling into my microphone, gonna be honest.
I get that, and I think that's an interesting point as well, is that part of game mastering and really selling it is embracing looking and sounding like a fool.
That is true. I do have very little shame, so I should probably work on that.
Yeah, absolutely. Like, you can... I don't want to get too down on you because you do have, like, a lot of strengths, but that's one thing I think helping to sell people into a scene helps them draw them in and make them want to get involved a bit more when you're being so over the top and providing that thing for them to latch onto.
Gotcha.
Become involved.
Become an actor almost. I mean, not LARPing, but do a little.
You gotta do LARPing. Yeah. Role playing is inherently sort of a pseudo performative art, as is LARPing. So embrace the inner LARP. Like we always say, live the LARP.
Fair enough.
You can say me wanting to move to Afghanistan, live in an old bombed out Soviet APC is a LARP, but at least it's an ethos.
No, that's not a LARP. That's not a LARP. That's a weird fantasy. That's what I'm saying.
At least it's an ethos.
the ethos is like Strasserism or whatever. The living in the bombed out APC is just a bizarre like fetish
at this point. I'm a Strasserist. I like Monster Girls, and I want to live in. No, it's a. I'm a Stalinist. I like Monster Girls, and I want to live in a bombed out APC. And these things are related.
I don't know.
I don't think the Monster Girl part has anything to do with the rest of that. Don't drag the beauty of Monster Girls into this.
Chief, him being.
No. No.
That's gonna be a hard yikes for me, sweaty.
Disavow, hard disavow.
I disavow you.
I disavow you back.
I double disavow you, you double wignat.
I disavow you to infinity.
This is so cute.
No, alright.
I disavow
shit,
you and Jack.
Oh! I'm editing. No, this is all getting cut. This is dumb.
Don't edit it out. It's funny. Everybody's going to love it.
Okay. Shall we segue into anything else, please?
Yeah, so speaking of things that are just going on this general cringy theme, right? We've got some premium grade A, fresh off the farm cringe. We have for you the Little Wars review of My Farrog, mythical fantasy role-playing game version 2.6 by Varg Vikernes.
That's right.
I believe his actual name is Christian.
Well, yeah, his name is Chris Chan Vikernes.
Oh. Ooh. Can you play as Sonichu in My Farrog?
Probably. Now, just to give you guys a little bit, he's got a bunch of special thanks. And he's got this really weirdly drawn, penciled-in rune on the front page. And it says, go to www.myfarrog.org to find a digital map of Thule, or as English speakers would pronounce it, Thule. Errata, updates, tutorials, quick reference sheets, and more. And what he means by quick reference sheets is he just means, like, reference sheets that are several pages long. So reference novels.
Yeah, there are so many like different parts of the character sheets you have to print out.
Now I would like to read off the inspirational RPGs and the inspirational writers for this role-playing game, because this really kind of sets the tone, okay?
Mm-hmm.
So the inspirational RPGs, Dungeons and Dragons BX, Harnmaster 1st and 3rd Edition, Middle Earth Role-Playing Game MERP, 1st and 2nd Edition, Rolemaster 2nd Edition, RuneQuest Deluxe Edition, Stalker the Sci-Fi Role-Playing Game, The One Ring RPG. And then here are the inspirational writers, okay?
Yeah.
Abs Jornsen and Moe, Shretton Detroyes, Cornelius.
I don't think that's Moe like the anime.
I'm type. Pronouncing it Moe because it's funnier. You've got Shretton okay. Detroyes, right. Cornelius Tacitus, Emil Berkeley, Epictetus. Or Epictetus. I don't know. Epictetus, okay? Epictetus.
Epictetus.
Tetus and he's epic, okay? The Grimm Brothers, H.P. Lovecraft, Homer, Homer Simpson, no, not Homer Simpson, but Homer, J.R.R. Tolkien. Wow, that's weird.
Okay. None of this is remotely relevant.
Oh no, dude! None of this is hilarious because look at the inspirational writers. He's got like Evola, Aurelius, Plato, Pythagoras of the Pythagorean theorem. Yes, Virgil.
None of that is Socrates.
Well, no,
Wolfram von.
See, what I want to do is I want to like kind of tell people. I want to set this up as this is who he claims. Inspired his writing, and then I want to like do a little bit of a compare and contrast, okay? Like,
well, you missed the most important sentence immediately after inspirational writers. My Farag was originally made as an educational tool for homeschooling.
What? Okay. What? Yeah.
What?
He wants to use racist, complex D&D for homeschooling.
Only one of those things is good in a role-playing game, and I'll give you one guess to what it is.
It's definitely not Dungeons or Dragons.
That's right. If you guess complexity, you're right. Yay!
No.
Let me do the irony bit. I did an irony, okay? Now, let's see. We've got all sorts of great, great, great rules. And by all sorts, I mean too goddamn many. This game has.
Yeah.
This game is about as complicated as GURPS. Without anything that makes GURPS actually like worth playing, that is to say, modularity and variety.
Yeah, I mean, this game spends so much of its complexity budget on things that are just so largely irrelevant that it just makes you wonder, like, is this some kind of weird game for autists?
I gotta say some of the best parts of this are like, you know how in Warhammer 40k rule books they'll have like these edgy quotes like, you know, an open mind is like a fortress with its gates unbarred and unguarded. Well, he has equally cringy and bad lines except like these lines.
Don't say equally, these are
worse. Yeah, these are worse. So like 40k may be doing a little bit overdone. These are just bad, like better to go without healing than call for an unskilled healer.
What the fuck does that mean?
No, do not cry before you are hurt.
The worst deaf is the one who does not want to hear.
What?
My favorite, though, my absolute favorite is, the wand is mightier than the sword.
Yep. Swimming is easy if someone holds your head above the water.
like, these are so much worse than the 40k ones.
Well, at least the 40k ones are like, yeah, okay, that's kind of true. You know, that's kind of true.
It is easier to hurt than to heal.
Death answers before she is asked. Hail Odin!
Hail Odin!
live for today, for tomorrow never comes.
A door must either be shut or open.
What?
That's one of them.
No, I think,
actually, that's
is it?
That's not true. Well, okay.
That isn't true. Better to light a candle than to curse the darkness.
I'm just like, why are you cursed in the darkness, nigga? Just light a candle. Like what?
How is darkness even real? Just right. Open your eyes. Like,
many have too much, but no one has enough.
Oh, really? How can you simultaneously say live for today for tomorrow never comes and then talk about scarcity? Like, that's because you ate it all yesterday.
Here's another one. The nut does not reveal the tree it contains.
All right. No, but okay, so those are cringy quotes.
You know,
but
if Varg actually wanted to do, like, the pagan Norse RPG, he could have just taken, like, that one thing of Norse sayings that we have and just interspersed those into it. It would have been less worse. Unless these are the Norse sayings, in which case I completely disavow the Norse.
I mean, yeah. Yeah, you should.
Oh, my lord.
As well, you should.
Oh, my lord. Just.
I just want to, real quick, I want to do a little quiz for Jack. So he has several very interesting skills in here that your characters can take.
Okay.
But one of them in specific is the skill Trickery.
Okay.
Now I want you to tell me, what do you think Trickery is?
Oh, this is good.
Oh no. Trickery. See, I don't have it in front of me. So this is
I know. You haven't looked at it at all. You do no prep before this. You just show up and think that's enough.
Well, I did. Moving.
I'm not wrong.
Moving on. Moving yeah, okay. on. I think trickery. Let's just go with the thought off the top of my head. I think trickery is a roguish skill, like a, you know, like a thief.
Wow, you are apparently in sync with Varg. Because trickery literally is pickpocketing.
That's it?
Yeah. Yeah. A trickery can enable your character to undetected steal items.
As opposed to just steal items. It's literally the skill from Skyrim.
Right. And at the very top of the list of difficulty modifications for trickery, the top one is make a nut disappear.
Oh, so sleight of hand. This is basically sleight of
hand. Well, yeah. Yeah, I mean, in terms of, like, yeah, stealing things. But, yeah, that I guess, yeah, that is sleight of hand. Make a nut. Unless it's, like, ooh, actually, that's not G-rated. Never mind. I'll keep that joke to myself. yeah, so trickery is a good one. But there are a lot of very interesting skills in here. I doubt you'll get this one. What do you think the skill tempo is?
Oh, no.
One of these skills is tempo.
Tempo. So maybe it's like standing on the street corner singing for donations. So like begging.
No, that's actually lyre playing or lute playing.
Oh, lute playing. Okay.
Those are both skills in here, lyre and lute playing. Yeah.
I think it's lyre, but it doesn't kind of matter.
Yeah. Well. Okay. Whatever. But no. What do you think tempo does?
Just singing, keeping a tempo.
You that makes more sense. But no, it's actually your movement speed.
What?
It's actually your movement speed.
Why not just say movement speed? Movement.
I don't know.
This is your movement.
No, he's got an entire chart in here, and it's like action, crawl, climb, sneak, track, carry heavy object, walk slash fly very slow, jog slash fly slow, run slash fly fast, sprint slash fly very fast, dash slash fly at full speed. And all of these are tempo divided by or multiplied by a number.
Now, Jack, I want you to take a quick guess. How fast do you think very fast is?
That's a good question.
I don't know, like sprinting?
Well, no. I want you to give me an actual answer in terms of like miles per hour, furlongs per fortnight, something. I don't know.
furlongs per fortnight.
Yeah, it's a sixth of a mile per 2 weeks. Just give me a speed, okay? Miles per hour.
Oh, okay.
How fast is very fast?
I'm going to say like 7 miles per hour.
Well, that's a better answer than Varg's, because Varg never actually defines how very fast is in the entire
Bark.
Yeah, I mean,
Yes.
it kind of depends on your it depends on your tempo, and see, like, it's a weird thing where it's like he's backwards defining these things. So if you want to run very fast, what you're really saying is I want to choose this specific speed modifier based on my tempo and also this specific rate at which my stamina is lost.
It's literally like your character has a transmission.
What gear do you want to move in right now? Yeah, pretty much. Yeah.
Yeah.
But no, the best part about this game is that every single activity that you might want to undertake has a related stamina cost that you have to be constantly tracking based on the amount of time related to that activity. So if you're sailing a ship, you lose one stamina every hour. But if you're running, you lose one stamina every minute. But if you're rowing a boat, one stamina every 15 minutes. If you're walking, you lose one every half hour.
So all of these are basically just like arbitrary.
No, there's a whole chart in here. And so if you're holding your breath, you lose two stamina every round. If you're engaged in melee, you lose one stamina every round. If you're driving a carriage, you lose one every hour. So no matter what you're doing, you are constantly and repeatedly having to keep track of every point of stamina lost based on the thing that you're doing that turn or that minute or that hour.
Now, I'm gonna be honest. I'm be honest with you guys. A lot of
I wish you would. I'm tired of the deception.
yeah, there you go. A lot of this reads like the rule book for an old Avalon Hill board game, except it's really clunky and doesn't make any sense.
I mean, it'd be like I am going through and reading all this. I cannot imagine trying to run this game.
I cannot imagine like even trying to play it, okay? Like your game master has to be like a freaking computer, and you have to be a freaking Chinaman who can do like differential calculus am not allow in his head instantaneously to even play this game.
I mean, it's
Well,
not that the math is complex. It's
yeah.
just there's so much of it for every single thing you'd want to do.
Yeah.
So much of
Yeah.
it. And what does it add? That's the thing that keeps getting back to me. It's like, what does it add if you mod, like, take care of the fatigue mod, weapon mod? Okay, so these are all like the effect, just to calculate your role for offense when you're attacking someone in melee. Melee skill proficiency plus encumbrance mod. If carrying a medium or heavy load, plus fatigue mod if tired, weary, or exhausted, plus weapon mod if any, plus one if carrying a shield or one weapon in each hand, plus other melee mods, see combat modifications. Then that goes up against the defensive value of 10 plus melee skill proficiency, plus shield mod if using a shield, plus encumbrance mod if etc., plus fatigue mod etc., plus weapon mod etc., plus other melee mods. That's just for melee. That he's got an entirely different list that's just as long for missile. Because there's no, it's just missiles. These guys are launching missiles at each other.
The missile knows where it is at all times.
Because it checked the chart in my
Yeah, there you go.
Farrakh. It's just, and then once you determine if you hit or not, you have to calculate the damage value. And there's an
John,
entirely,
I'm just
oh,
gonna
I
like
know.
truncate this and say this what you're reading basically sounds like someone reading the algorithm of a very poorly written like high schooler's first JavaScript program.
This is the definition of fantasy heartbreaker. The people who are like, I like D&D, but I think I can do better. And then they do the opposite of better. They make it worse, massively
So
worse.
those who are not so for those not in the know, do you want to like define for the audience really fast what a quote unquote fantasy heartbreaker is?
Okay, let me repeat that sentence I just said. They see D&D and think they can do better and set out to remake it even better, and then it's absolutely worse.
Ah, so that's the literal definition.
Yeah, that's what a fantasy heartbreaker. It's a D&D clone made by non-professionals, by amateurs, who are then convinced that it's amazing because they added in, encumbrance mods and fatigue mods and double weapon mods and all this extra stuff that they, this complexity that they felt like D&D was missing, to really have that simulator of wandering around Thule simulator.
Yeah. I'm going to be honest, though.
I wish you would.
Chief. Chief, let me be straight with you, Chief.
I really wish you would on that one.
Chief. Chief, let me be straight up. Let me just be stand up with you, Chief. Here's the thing. This game is entirely, like, unnotable. Like, nobody would care about this game were it not for its author. Varg is the only reason anybody cares about My Frog, and the only reason anybody cares about My Frog is that it's made by Varg, and the only reason anybody cares about Varg is because he's Varg. I'm not going to go into, like, why people care about Varg, because, quite frankly, that's not really the purview of our program, but I'll suffice to leave it at that. My Frog, as an RPG, is very terrible.
Bloated. I would call it bloated.
I would say that My Frog has, and this is going to sound weird coming from me, too many spreadsheets. It is poorly written, poorly optimized, has no game flow, has no thematic game. Like, the themes of the game, whatever they are, don't really tie in with the mechanics very well. And the game, it's...
Well, that's another thing. It's what are the themes of this game? Because it doesn't... There's no section on, like, how to run or set up adventures in this game. There's no GM advice. There's no player advice. There's no role-playing advice. It is literally just a mass of bloated...
It's
just contextless mechanics.
It's literally just Varg's wish to run around and hail Odin all day. That's,
yeah,
like,
literally.
Right.
I'm be honest. I think the targeted player base of this game would actually understand what the setting was and how to play it, because the setting is literally just Pagang, and the player advice is hail Odin harder than everybody else. There you go. The problem there being, regardless of what you think of that as a concept, and that can be debated on its own merits, the game itself is just horrible in both executing that concept and being a basic game generally. Quite frankly, I'd rather be castrated than play this game, ever.
Okay, I don't.
Okay, maybe not that far. I'd rather amputate my left arm with a frickin' rusty saw blade than play this game. Let's just say that. That'd be less painful, and the pain constantly searing into my brain would consume less of my mental energy than keeping track of my frickin' fatigue points.
So here's my question then, Mongoose. Would you play this game if you just if you cut out the terrible rules and just, like, impose some sort of...
There's no game left.
Yeah, I was about to say, if you cut
rules.
Out the terrible rules, you have the My Frog cover and then the back cover of My Frog.
Oh.
Which, by the way, in this version of the PDF that we found, the back cover is a scan of a man's hairy ass. I'm not joking.
Yes. Yes.
So the dude who scanned
what?
This.
Yes.
The dude who scanned this and uploaded the PDF took a scan of his buttocks and put it in there as the final page.
That's the final page, and then you have the back cover.
That's right. What we should leave everyone with.
It's disgusting.
Yeah.
I just want to get... No, the thing I want to leave you with...
Funny.
And what's really disturbing is that there's a chart earlier on that you could tell he was, like, thinking about this or whatnot, or maybe he did the butt scan early because there's a butt hair that's over one of the tables. it's terrible. But I just want to leave you all with this little bit of pagan wisdom that was from one of the quotes from the book. You cannot kill what is already dead.
Now, I wanna add on that a little bit, and I wanna read the back cover.
Okay.
Because I think we've actually been looking at this the wrong...
You're not talking about the butt, are you?
No, not the butt. There's nothing to read on the butt. There's actually a back cover underneath the butt. And it says, do you like fairy tales, fantasy, horror, and mythology? Then My Frog is the game for you. The rules of My Frog are very modular, meaning the level of complexity is all up to the myth masters and the players.
What?
You can play the game rules light as well as rules heavy, you decide. For news, updates, tutorials, examples, maps, and much more, go to www.myfrog.org. And this is the funny thing about this is nothing in the rule set indicates modularity except on the back cover.
Right. I mean, it's basically like, are you getting sick of all these rules? Well, stop using them, dummy.
And then the bit there is, all these rules are so bizarrely interconnected. Like, I think the most egregious thing here is the stamina point system, but that is so core to the way you do everything else, you can't just ignore it.
Yeah, I mean...
Like, at least with Savage Worlds, like, the rules just rely on baseline things, and then you can kind of cut them out as you don't want them. But here, it's just so blatant, like, ugh. The prioristic baseline of mechanical, like, sort of interaction is just based on this very horrible system.
Yeah. No, I mean, he does have a little bit of setting information in here, but it's all related to, like, pagan gods and Seder and Asatru and weird, like, fake religious holidays like Cuck Day. Yeah, Cuck Day. It's just Cuck Day, yeah.
He has a glossary in the back of, like, pagan words or something.
Yeah, oh, yeah, yeah.
But the problem is Varg has a tendency to use those, like, English letters with the weird things attached to them so that, like, nothing in the... None of the pronunciations are immediately clear to an English reader. Especially considering the book is written in English. You should use the diphthongs as opposed to the accents, you dingus. There's a reason we have, like, combinations that make different sounds, genius.
Yeah, use thongs.
Yeah, well, I just want to leave us off then on another cringy pagan quote from the book that is really relevant considering what is the second to final page in the PDF. Advice should be viewed from behind.
Wait. What?
I don't know what the quote means, but it's very apt considering the end of the book.
my version says something in Norse, and it says, "You shall be friends with your friends and his friends, but no man shall ever be friend with the friend of an enemy."
That's from
the Havamal. So maybe all these quotes he had all over the place were from the Havamal.
Mongoose, I want to view this segment from behind.
Like the PDF copies of MyFrog we're looking at, we're just gonna close this out and leave you guys until we won't leave you guys forever, but we will probably be leaving those PDF copies of MyFrog forever. So this has been Little Wars. We'll see you next week. Goodbye.
Bye.
See ya.